Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Book Omi. If you're a Bookomite, you'll know that the Omi in Book Omi stands for the original memorable insights that we find in books written by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, arts, and culture. In this episode,
I'm Grace Campbell, author of Amazing Disgrace, and this is my Omi for Book Omi.
We share Omi with the stand-up comedian, comedy club founder, activist, and the co-host of the Football Feminism and Everything in Between podcast, which she co-hosts with her dad, Alistair Campbell.
The idea to them of a 26-year-old now writing a memoir is a bit absurd, but these are the kind of books that other young people do really relate to and do really connect with. And then once they started to read that, my mum especially was like, I can see the impact that this is going to have on people.
In Amazing Disgrace, a book about shame, Grace Campbell grabs you by the hand and takes you on a whirlwind tour of childhood, adolescence and young adulthood, growing up in a playground of political celebrity, idiot boys and brilliant girlfriends. Grace, welcome to Book Omi.
Oh my God, that was such a nice introduction.
Thank you very much. It's a stunning book. I tell you what, we'll cover the dad bit straight away, but because I know I've interviewed your dad a lot. And the first time I interviewed him, I was very nervous. He's quite a formidable character, as you know. But I was more nervous about interviewing you.
Oh, because... I love that. Why?
Because of the book. It's a book about growing up as a girl and a young woman, and it's completely candid and honest. So I was like, should I be reading this? I felt like I was intruding in a way. With your dad, there's common ground. There's a lot of common ground. But we have common ground in that you love comedy, I love comedy. I've got a Yorkshire dad.
Yeah.
And we both, I assume you like your dad today. We both like your dad a lot.
Me and my dad are good friends,
So we do have quite a lot in common.
Yeah, and also I'm really glad that you, because I do think it's important with this book that not just young women read it, but that parents of young women read it. Because I hope that even my mum reading it, she was like, God, I really didn't know you were going through some of that stuff. And I wish I'd have known then. And I feel that parents will be able to understand their daughters a bit better from reading this book.
I'm assuming, putting myself in your shoes for a moment, and also when you do read a book, you do because you get in, you know, you spend time in someone's company, that's one of the most difficult things about writing a memoir, a personal memoir, is what your parents think. It's a book about shame, a great title, Amazing Disgrace, but you must be proud.
Yeah, I am proud of it, and I think I have to be, first of all, because I called the book Amazing Disgrace, and the whole concept of that is obviously my name's Grace, and this Amazing Grace, the song, is something that's just got a huge relevance to my family and our life. And I've never been graceful. That was just an ongoing joke of my life. All of my family, all of our family friends would be like, you shouldn't be called Grace. I'm the most ungraceful person, in a good way. But I did used to be ashamed of that. Like, I was too loud, I was too clumsy, I was messy, I was sort of disorganized and quite chaotic, all things that I used to not be proud of. And that's why I love the title. And then I feel once I wrote it, I knew I was going to call it Amazing Disgrace before I wrote it. Like, I was like, that's what this book has to be called, because it's all about shame and it's all about owning the things that I've been told to be ashamed of and the shame that doesn't actually belong in me. And then I wrote it and I was like, oh, this is actually amazing. Like, I am incredibly proud of it, because I didn't really know I had it in me, to be honest, to write a book like that. I was like, obviously I want to do it because it's something that it's an amazing thing to do. But I didn't know if I was going to be any good at it. And once I started, I really, really got into it.
And there's a really good arc to the book as well. It's really quite satisfying. It must have been really quite satisfying to write it. I was really nervous about talking to you today, and I was nervous about reading the book, and I was quite slightly afraid, because you gave me this insight into what it's like being a girl growing up, and then a young woman and then an adult. And I felt really like, oh my God, what can I do? And I've got two daughters, and I was like, oh, I need to do something. I need to help. And you've gone through all this with incredibly intelligent and caring and active parents, you know, in their own way. And we all have parents, you know, I've got a Yorkshire dad too. And did you feel alone in that process? Did you feel like in sharing through the book that you've shared that experience and you can kind of move on from it?
I did feel alone. I did. And I felt incredibly vulnerable writing it, because going from doing stand-up comedy where you get immediate reaction, you know if people like you or not straight away in the room, you see them. And then, you know, however they react to you, you can take that as you will. But writing a book is a really isolating process. There's no way of avoiding that, because you sit on your own. You talk about some, you know, some funny things, some light things, some incredibly dark things. As you said, like the process of growing up, especially as a young woman, you do come across quite traumatic things. And it did make me feel, my mental health was very tumultuous during it. I mean, and we were in lockdown, so it was sort of just a really weird time in life and I couldn't do anything. But after and now, I feel I worked through so many things about myself while writing it. So now that I've done it, I feel I've really come to understand like how I sort of got to the person that I am today, how many things I've overcome. You know, when you do see things on a page like that, you process it in a completely different way. It was really hard to do it, but it was so therapeutic and I'm so glad I did.
Were you worried about your parents reading it?
No, not really, because like my parents, I mean, obviously all I want to do is impress them. I want them to think it's amazing. They're both writers. So I wanted them to be like, when I told them at the beginning of lockdown, I was like, oh, I've got a book deal. And they were like, oh, what's the book? And I was like, well, it's a sort of memoir about being a young woman. And they just hysterically laughed. And they were like, you're 25, turning 26. Who do you think you are? Like, why are you writing a memoir? And I was like, listen, guys, people are going to want to read it. Trust me. And then I started to write it and they started to understand more and more what I meant by that, which is like, it's a new, you know, the idea to them of a 26-year-old now writing a memoir is a bit absurd, but these are the kind of books that other young people do really relate to and do really connect with. And then once they started to read that, my mum especially was like, I can see the impact that this is going to have on people.
And you packed a lot into your life as a kid, mainly not through your choice. You grew up in the middle of a political playground. You were rubbing shoulders, actually, even as a quite short, you know, you were a kid, but he was quite short. Putin was quite short, so you probably were rubbing shoulders with him.
Literally, my shoulder, I was leaning over him.
But you were kind of
9-year-old.
And as a kid, you're sort of tagging along in these corridors of power. Did that make you feel powerful or powerless?
I think it was both. And this is actually, this is the constitution of my mind now, still from my childhood. I, at the same time, all the time, feel both incredibly powerful and amazing and incredibly powerless and insecure at the same time. So my mind zigzags between those two places really often. And the goal of my life now is to even that out and find more balance, because I think from the childhood that I had, it was so manic and so normal. It was so kind of like high pressure and so chilled. Like we had these two really kind of contrasting settings to our childhood, which meant that I'm very good at adapting, but also constantly kind of having to catch up with where my head's going and how my anxiety is. Because when I was a kid, it was like, yeah, we were around all of these powerful men. And I was like, I want to be like all of them. And in a way, I'm better than them because my dad loves me more than he loves them. But at the same time, I'm not one of them. I'm not invited into the room, into the big rooms. I'm not sitting at their table. So I think it was really, it set me up with this kind of contradictory mindset.
I think loads of kids with workaholic parents can relate to that, even if you experienced it in the extreme. That kind of something that kids can't articulate, but they just feel, you know, why is mummy or daddy more interested, or why are they taking that call now? It's, you know, it's reading time, or this is a common thing, but you just had it in a very intense way.
I do think it is like this is so common, and it does have really interesting effects on kids. I think it definitely made me an attention seeker, because all I wanted was to get their attention. That has led me to be someone who just wants to perform all the time. So it informs parts of you that you don't really work out until you, I don't know, write a book about it or do therapy.
Most kids sort of might feel jealous of their parents with, you know, going off to work or being involved in sport. But you had the British Prime Minister to deal with as your arch rival, you know, for your dad's attention and your mum's, really, because they were all involved, weren't they? They're all involved in the same relationship.
Yeah, they were both working full time there.
Yeah. I think that's your dad bit out of the way. Because he's only one part of your life.
He is. He's only like in two chapters.
You deal with that really well, and you do a podcast with him, and I've listened to it. I can hear what you're thinking in your voice when your dad says something, and he doesn't mean to be as offensive as he's being to you. I can hear your mind desperately not trying to take offence, and the fact that it's your dad, and you're thinking, how should I respond to that?
So we get into such big arguments on that podcast because of that exact reason, which is that we are both really strong personalities and we're both incredibly stubborn. And what he has found really challenging about me is that I take him on in a way that he was like, wait, what? I made you, like, what are you, how dare you turn around and tell me I don't know what I'm talking about, you know nothing. It's like that scene in Matilda when Danny DeVito's like, I'm big, you're small, I'm right, you're wrong. That's literally me and my dad over and over again.
Anyway, he is the dad in the room, but so we had to talk about it. We had to put that also because he is a big part of your life and he's a big part of your early life, but now you're you and you've been on this arc, you've been on this journey as, God, that sounded like therapy, didn't it? You've lived your life in the way that you have punched through, and you have punched through the very competitive and hard to break into world of stand-up comedy, and you've done that on your own, and you make a joke about being Alistair Campbell's daughter and everything like that, but to earn the right to be on any stage, be it four people in a room or 400, it takes a lot of guts and it takes a lot of self-belief and it takes a lot of support. I've got friends, female friends in the entertainment industry and I didn't even notice this along the way, they were working literally, physically twice as hard as their counterparts to get where they are. How has that changed? Because I'm talking about 10, 15 years ago now, but you're in the thick of it now. It's a bit of a cliche now that stand-up comedy is male-dominated, but is it still as bad as it was?
I don't think so. I mean, I think I feel really grateful to the female comics who have been doing this for a really long time. And because it's because of them that when I started doing stand-up, it was weird in the open mic circuit. When you're doing open mics, you are usually the only girl on the lineup, because that's just there are more men, I think, who have that sort of confidence in their head to think, I can do this. And no offense, but a lot of them are really shit, but they still do it because they're like, you know, it's that same thing as women and men in the workplace. Men are way more likely to go for a job they're not actually eligible for, when women won't do that, even if they have got all of the perfect experience. So in the open mic level, it was definitely that. And I felt uncomfortable quite a lot of the time because there's two things that were going on for me. One being who I am. So people were a bit like, oh, she's just, you know, she's just using who she is to basically get on the stage and get stage time. And then there were people being like, oh, she's just a girl. That was at that level. And then once I did The Fringe and you sort of earn a different type of respect, I think. And then I built more of a profile. I now mainly just do gigs that I put on or that friends of mine put on, which are mainly all female lineups. And, you know, there's a really nice now new small circuit that are just nights like that, so that you don't just have to rely on those nights where you are the token woman on the lineup.
Do you know Viv Groskopf? I don't know if you read her book, I Laughed, I Cried, about her journey trying to do 100 stand-ups, and it sounded very similar to your, but you had that friendship support, didn't you? You had your friends that would go along with you.
Well, that's the thing, that's what I talk about in the book. It's I wouldn't have done that if my friends weren't backing me completely. They came to every single one of my gigs. They made me feel like, even when I'd have a really shit gig, like, and there was like two people in the audience and every joke fell flat, they would be there to be like, nope, you were amazing, you can't give up. And I wouldn't have done it without them.
No. And it's incredible, once you've been through that, how it makes you stronger. You kind of almost get addicted to going back to it and seeing what it's going to be like. So I grew up with Al Murray when he first started, and he used to do the toilet circuit. And it was incredible how I just was in awe of how brave he was standing up. And he used to break the wall and say to people, you do know I am just a character, I'm not a racist. You know, because you'd go to Imperial College and they'd go, racist.
It's honestly like, and I talk about this in the book, I used to be so bad with rejection, But doing stand-up, you get really good at just accepting that not everyone's going to like you. And it's such a liberating feeling. And you have to have that as a stand-up because not everyone is going to like you.
Let's talk about your strong opinions as well, because you know, you have that amazing personality, you have that amazing strength, but you also recognize your weaknesses and you embrace your weaknesses. Divisiveness in terms of your coming onto the scene for stand-up and comedy and media, everybody seems to have an opinion on everything, left versus right, you know, women versus men versus men, women versus women. It's like you've got to pick a side. When our parents, both of our parents, were growing up, you could sort of, there were less sides to pick, it would seem. Is there a middle ground left?
I think so. I mean, I think there's a real change in the conversation actually happening right now, where lots of people are saying that cancel culture has gone too far to some degree because we aren't seeing the nuance in things enough. And I think I think young people get a really bad rap. that felt really weird saying that. Because people think we're, you know, woke, gone too far, or like PC brigade or boring snowflakes. I really don't think that's true. I think obviously, I don't generalize people, but I think most of the people that I follow and I look at who are in my generation really do understand like the nuance in certain topics. And obviously some feminists hate men and will never involve men in the conversation. Others will definitely do that. Like, I'm personally someone who thinks that we need to involve men in the conversation because then we'll get more done. And I also think men suffer in their own specific ways because of the patriarchy. So I think we have to see the nuance. I definitely do, and most of the people I know do. But I do feel that young people have this bad reputation that people like Piers Morgan and, you know, people like that sort of ham home a bit too much. And I just don't really think it's true that we're that kind of, not even sensitive, but like black and white.
Well, you say when women aren't supporting other women, the patriarchy thrives, and you use the image of a lush bath bomb spreading out. In your experience, how does not supporting each other manifest itself, and how do you call it out?
Well, I think, for example, most of the women who work with Donald Trump in the States would be like people that I would say are letting the patriarchy thrive, because in enabling this awful man who wants to, you know, take away the rights of women, that is very unfeminist as an act. And I think the way I talk about it in the book more personally is that we are taught at school that you have to compete with your peers, so you have to be the best over all of the other girls who are doing what you're doing. And that seeps into my adult life, because I'll still get this feeling of like, oh my God, someone else who I know who does similar stuff to me has a book coming out on the same day as me. My book needs to do better. It needs to do better, because I'm like, oh, I have. And you know, that's really ingrained in you. It's very hard to eliminate that. And that's what I mean, where like when women support each other, which I have made part of my sort of daily practice now, firstly, you feel better and you feel supported all the time. I only did stand up because of my female friends, so I wouldn't have done that without them. But also, when you sort of band together, you can do more to like object to the majority of the stupid men who are in power.
And I recognize some of the, you know, colossal arseholes in your book that you describe. I assume you've changed their names.
Yes.
And I recognise them. And, you know, we've all met a Will in our lives, some party or somewhere. But most men I know, myself included, don't think we're arseholes. I mean, you know, it would be quite hard to live with ourselves if we did. Not all the time. We know that we're capable of arseholish behaviour. Oh, but are we all self-deluded? Who or what is to blame? Are we just ignoring the fact that we are?
I think not all. I don't think like all men are twats at all. And I think, you know, I give two examples of like, oh, I give like a few examples of like positive men in my life in the book, some friends and a boyfriend and my dad. But So I don't think all men are like that, but I do think there is a level of when men, and this is again a generalization, but when men don't have enough non-romantic engagement with women, I feel they don't understand women in the same way. So they don't, and that's how the life becomes very us and them. So I went to a girls' school, which was next door to a boys' school, and my brothers went to that boys' school. All of my friends from school who were boys didn't go to the boys' school. They went to a mixed school because those boys were socialized with girls and they were capable of being friends with girls. Whereas the boys at the school next door to mine, which was a boys' school, didn't know how to be friends with girls, not in a sort of romantic sexual capacity. And that's what's really interesting to me, because I feel all of those boys that I talk about as positive men in my life all have really strong female friendships and really strong relationships with women that aren't romantic. And I do think that helps a lot, because I think a lot of the dickhead behavior comes from men looking at a girl like me and being like, well, I don't want to fuck her, so I can't get anything out of her. There's no purpose for her. And it's that scene where in the book with that, where I meet that man who I had a meeting with, who said a really awful thing to me. But that's exactly the kind of man I mean, who looks at someone like me and is like, completely dismisses me as someone he would ever consider even wanking to, and therefore is like, well, I've got no use talking to her.
I like the way that that's the bottom line, that's the base mark, even wanking to.
Yeah. He wouldn't even hate that. Yeah.
It's that bad.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying, because, you know, having grown up, I went to a boys' school, but I've got an older sister.
Yeah.
And lots of very strong women in my life. My public school friends have really struggled, unless they were lucky enough to meet or mix with strong, positive women. And it takes until they're in their 30s or the 40s.
Oh, my God. And that's the thing, because they go off to boarding school at 10 or 11. And if you're in a boys' boarding school, you have no interaction with women who aren't like the matron or whatever they call it. Yeah. And then those are the boys that are now running the country. So we're fucked, really.
Yeah, or not, as the case may be. Yeah, so you made, well, several times in the book, but you made me laugh out loud, in particular with, I mean, your descriptions of things and yourself, generally at your own expense. You said you felt like you were looking like a thumb at the L photo shoot. And I think that's a brilliant way of describing a bad day.
Yeah.
You were in a photo shoot with your mate Scarlett Curtis. And it's very disarming when someone makes fun of themselves, I think, and I don't really trust people who aren't self-deprecating. Why do we put ourselves down? Are we pushing ourselves down when we should be really bigging ourselves up?
I think because I big myself up like so much, but I do think self-deprecation is incredibly relatable, and it's a really good way to connect with other people, to admit that you feel you have flaws. Because it's not even to say like we need to do that, but I like self-deprecation, A, because I'm not really a fan of taking the piss out of other people in that way. I would never like be like, oh, that person looks like a thumb, because that's not very nice. I can say it about myself, and maybe I could say it about my dad and people I'm close to, but you know what I mean? Like, that's not really what I'm like. I don't like sort of taking the piss out of the way other people look, but I'll do that about myself because that's my choice to make. And it's not to say that I don't think I'm amazing, but on some days I do wake up and I do feel quite thumbish. You know, I do just like want to sit in a massive jumper with my hood up and avoid eye contact with all mirrors.
You launched the Disgraceful Club in Soho. That's the right name, isn't it? The Disgraceful Club. Not a Disgraceful Club in Soho, after your first Edinburgh Festival. Because you went through that experience. I've been through that experience and lived up
there. Have you?
It's amazing, yeah. It used to smell of Weetabix when I was up there, because there was a brewery, but I don't think it's there anymore.
Right,
but it's a rite of passage, isn't it?
It is.
And that gave you the confidence and the verve and the momentum to set up this club. Have you kept it going through COVID?
So the Disgraceful Club we launched with The Box in Soho, which is like an incredible club, and as a space it's just unbelievable. And it was their first comedy night. Unfortunately, we only launched it last November, so we didn't get a huge amount of like running time with it, but it is a pretty iconic night. And I have kind of decided that I only want it to exist if it's at The Box, because it's like, it feels pretty synonymous with that venue. So I've carried on doing comedy, and I've been doing some live shows with my friend Anoni, and we've got some more in November in a socially distanced venue in Soho. And the Disgraceful Club, I'm going to do some Zoom things around my book. The vibe of the Disgraceful Club is so anarchic and but also glamorous and cool that I feel I don't really want to imitate it, like, online, basically. I mean, I did a few online gigs in the lockdown, and I did like three, and I was like to my agent, can you just not, I just don't want to do these. It's actually really depressing to me. Like, it makes me think I'm a terrible comic and never want to do it again. And I'm like, I'd rather just wait till I'm in front of a crowd. But I did this one online gig, and honestly, afterwards I was like, oh, I have to quit. Like, I am so bad at stand-up. But it's just because you can't hear anyone. You can't react to anyone. So, yeah.
It's all about the reaction, isn't it? And feeding off the people in the room.
I mean, otherwise, what are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. So it's not that long ago in the great scheme of things, but if you could have a word with the sort of 15-year-old Grace Campbell with the bottle of Glens in her hand in the park, what would you say to her?
A few things. First of all, the boys that are rejecting you now are complete trash, and please do not care what they think about you. You're going to get into your 20s and everyone's going to love you because they'll grow into that. You really don't need to think about anything else apart from the fact that you've got the most amazing friends and you're so incredibly supported by them. And I feel that, I mean, all of those friends that I was friends with now are still my best friends. So I feel incredibly lucky about that. I think that's my main one, is really don't care about the boys thing. Yeah.
Grace Campbell, thanks for sharing your Omi with Bookomi today.
Thank you for having me.
Grace's book, Amazing Disgrace, A Book About Shame, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bookomi pod, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe. And remember, a skunk Anansi should have said, just because it feels good, it doesn't make it wrong. Bye for now.